Now we can catch up on stories making headlines around the world. It's World Report with Justin McCarthy.
Good morning. On today's programme, divided opinion over octopus farming in the Canaries and smoke-free skiing in France. But first we go to Scotland, which has a new First Minister. 37-year-old Humza Yousaf has roots in Pakistan and Kenya, but his focus will firmly be on Scotland and efforts to secure a new independence referendum for the country, as Lorraine Mallander reports.
Scotland made history this week with the arrival in power of Humza Yousaf. Glaswegian through and through, from his love of iron brew to his humorous patter, he's the first Muslim to lead not only Scotland, but a Western democratic nation. The symbolism cast a warm glow over his inauguration, the Scots-Pakistani leader savouring the moment with his Palestinian heritage wife and their two children. It was the dawning of a new era of diversity. But judging by the headlines, the honeymoon is over. Yousaf enters office in firefighting mode, having inherited a dismal track record on issues like transport and NHS waiting times, the latter a legacy of his own stint as health minister. His Scottish National Party is in a shambles, bitterly divided after 16 years in power, with no shortage of malcontents waiting to trip him up. It also faces a probe into more than half a million pounds in funds that went missing from the party's war chest. Keeping the sinking ship afloat will mean convincing a sustained majority of weary Scots battling to pay bills that independence is still relevant. All the while, he'll need to keep his eye on the prize, plotting how to secure powers for a second independence vote, aka IndyRef 2, from a recalcitrant Westminster. The Labour Party is circling, looking to claw back votes ahead of the next general election, sometime before late January 2025. In his first parliamentary session as leader, Yousaf's critics derided him as a ChatGPT-style bot, slavishly repeating his predecessor Nicola Sturgeon's progressive agenda in areas like transgender rights and welfare reforms. But there's a bit more to him than that. The son of immigrants who arrived in Glasgow in the 60s, Yousaf is a conviction politician with a compelling backstory. As one SNP insider at Westminster told RTE, Yousaf is someone who incarnates radical change simply because of who he is. His father hailed from the town of Mian Chanu in Pakistan, while his mother was born into a South Asian family in Kenya. Her family fled the country after a rise in violence against the Asian population, which saw his grandmother receiving an axe to the back. His paternal grandfather took a job at a sewing machine factory in Clydebank to support the family. Launching his bid for the top job nearby, Yousaf said, "I see my ancestral roots as being not just Pakistani, but running through Clydebank, which brought me to where I am today." He was turned on to politics after 9/11. His classmates at Hutchison's Grammar School in Glasgow asked him questions like, "Why do Muslims hate America?" Rather than going on the defensive, Yousaf started to read about his religion and culture. By 2003, he was marching against the US-led invasion of Iraq in London. A couple of years later, while reading politics at the University of Glasgow, he joined the SNP, impressed by an anti-war speech by former party leader Alex Salmond. It struck Yousaf that only independence would prevent Scotland from being dragged into another illegal war. His old pal Akhtar Khan, a community activist who used to play football with him in Glasgow's Queen's Park, noticed his powers of persuasion from the get-go. "His wittiness and humour helped because it made him likeable," he says. "The rest of us were quite in your face and a bit too passionate." When the SNP came to power in 2007, Yousaf worked for the late Bashir Ahmad, the first non-white member of the Scottish Parliament who'd arrived from Pakistan in the early 60s, stepping off a coach from London with nothing but an address scribbled on a scrap of paper. Ahmad founded Scots Asians for Independence. Convener Kasim Hanif says Ahmad became Yousaf's mentor. Bashir used to say, "Whenever you walk into a room, make sure you shake everyone's hands." Humza has abided by that, he says. When Ahmad died of a heart attack in 2009, Alex Salmond quickly recruited his young assistant as an aide. The SNP could just have let Hamza leave, says Ahmad's son Atif, a Glasgow dentist. They didn't want that to happen. They saw him as someone who had talent. His subsequent rise was stratospheric, though some have accused him of failing upwards. As Transport Minister in 2016, for example, he was fined £300 for driving a friend's car without insurance. Promoted to Justice Secretary in 2018, his hate crime bill, which banned stirring up hatred, sparked rancorous debate over freedom of speech. But Yousaf's promise to be the party's first activist has a ring of authenticity. Rosa Sally, an SNP councillor in Glasgow who arrived in Scotland as a refugee from Iraq in 2001, first met him at a protest for refugee rights. "He's always turned up, always spoken," she says. "For many people, that comes across as leadership. Hamza understands people from different backgrounds. He has that understanding of people's struggles." During the leadership debates, Yousaf's fierce defence of the party's progressive values brought the growing chasm between Scotland and England into sharper focus. While Rishi Sunak's Tory government at Westminster is cracking down on asylum seekers arriving across the English Channel, freely admitting to potential human rights breaches, the SNP government at Holyrood wants to open Scotland's doors. "What the Tories are doing in government is dog whistles to the far right," says Asa Samake-Roman, a French journalist based in Edinburgh. In Scotland, they're not having that. Indyref 2 doesn't look likely for now, Sunak having already rejected Yousaf's call for a transfer of powers. It's the same obstacle that Sturgeon kept running up against, the elephant in the room. But in his bid to create a kinder, more egalitarian society, Yousaf looks like he means business. Fergus Much, the SNP's former head of communications, knows him well. Having tackled racist abuse head-on throughout his career, he has well-tuned moral antennae, he says. If he thinks he should go into battle for something, for example social justice, oh boy, he will go for it, he says. Yousaf looks like he's going in on the front foot in this battle, not only for his own career, but for the very survival of his party. For World Report, this is Lorraine Mallander.
Next to the Canary Islands, where plans for an octopus farm in Las Palmas have divided opinion among animal rights campaigners and seafood lovers. From the Canaries, Cliona O'Flynn reports.
Whether your awareness of the strange world of the intelligent, eight-limbed, soft-bellied creatures was first awakened when Paul the Octopus rightly predicted Spain would win the 2010 World Cup, or when you were drawn into the underwater kelp world of the Oscar-winning film My Octopus Teacher, the existence of these creatures as more than scary denizens of the deep is widespread these days, as is acknowledgement of their level of intelligence. Octopus is a very popular dish here in Spain and in many other countries. Whether it's eaten fried or grilled in salads, hot or cold, it's a first choice for millions of regular diners. It's estimated that 350,000 tons of octopus are caught and eaten annually. And despite the possible change in public opinion regarding the intelligence of these creatures, their popularity among diners has continued to rise, so much so that wild catch numbers are dwindling. Last year, here in the Canary Islands, the Nueva Pesca Nova company decided to apply for a license to create and operate the first intensive commercial octopus farm in the world. The application is pending, but the general feeling was that the regional government didn't see any reason to reject the application. While short-lived, octopus grow fast, produce lots of offspring, and fetch a good price on the market, making them very appealing to commercial aquacultural companies. The new facility would be located in the port of Las Palmas in Gran Canaria, employ 450 people and produce the equivalent of 10% of the Spanish fleet's octopus landings. Once the news broke, though, a myriad of groups very quickly launched international objections to the creation of such a farm, and with reasons that range from cruelty to environmental damage potential. Leading the charge are international bodies such as the Eurogroup for Animals and locally an organisation known as PACMA, an animal rights environmental group. They say that the plans by Nueva Pesca Nova, with creatures confined in small tanks, will include the use of a cruel slaughter method, which would see live creatures plunged into ice-cold slurry to kill them. And this method of slaughter has been the focus of much of the protest. Reinike Hamelers, the Eurogroup CEO, says that with the current revision of the animal welfare legislation, the European Commission now has a real opportunity to avoid the terrible suffering of millions of animals and that they cannot afford to leave aquatic animals behind. Elana Lara, research manager at Compassion in World Farming, adds that the proposed intensive farming methods will inflict unnecessary suffering on these intelligent, sentient and fascinating creatures, which need to explore and engage with the environment as part of their natural behaviour. Furthermore, regardless of your stance on eating fish, meat or mollusks, according to these experts, the method that would be used to breed these creatures would damage the environment. Lara points out that the octopus diet requires huge quantities of animal protein to sustain them, contributing to overfishing at a time when fish stocks are already under immense pressure. One group of New York-based environmental scientists have also previously argued that it's not possible to humanely raise octopuses in captivity at a commercial scale and could indeed cause not just pollution from the release of contaminated waters, but cannibalism in animals that have effectively been driven mad. However, Nueva Pescanova boasted in 2019 of having succeeded at not only raising octopuses in captivity, but for the first time getting them to reproduce. CEO Ignacio González said, "We will continue to research how to improve the well-being of the octopuses, studying and replacing their natural habitat with the expectation to be able to sell aquaculture octopus starting in the year 2023. They've also recently told the BBC that their slaughter methods are not cruel and involve proper handling that avoids any pain or suffering to the animal. And the company adds that they could also help restock wild populations in coming years through releasing juveniles back into the wild. The regional government has yet to take that final decision. And now this week, PACMA have announced details of a large international event in April, their second public protest at the proposed farm. They're holding simultaneous events in a number of Spanish cities and seven other countries, and now have garnered the support of many more international groups, including PETA and the Jane Goodall Institute. Either way, while the Canarian government makes up its mind, octopus will remain firmly on the Spanish menu. Fish farming is already well established here anyway, and people are not going to change their dietary habits or their minds overnight. A survey in a Canarian newspaper saw 84% in favour of the creation of an octopus farm. So whether local public opinion will trump international protests is yet to be seen. For World Report, this is Cliona O'Flynn in the Canary Islands.
Finally, we go to France, where one ski resort in the country has gone smoke-free. It's the latest in an effort by the Léger Resort to bolster its clean green credentials, as Connor Power reports.
At the French ski resort of Léger in the northern French Alps, the local tourism officials are happy. They're content not only because their visitor numbers are up on 2019 figures, but because they have become the first smoke-free ski resort in all of Europe. This is an idea which has already been tried in North America, Japan and New Zealand with a lot of success. In fact, New Zealand has decided to go where no government has gone before in their attempts to eradicate smoking altogether from their country. But how does such an idea go down in France, a country with a strong tradition of protesting and of smoking? Although levels of smoking have dropped in the land of Gitans, along with virtually every other country, the percentage of people that smoke every day in France is above the EU average at just under 20% of the population, going by the latest official statistics. According to Alexis Bongard, director of the Léger tourist office, the non-smoking policy has been well received, with precious little complaints and lots of compliance. Léger had a huge amount of snow in the latter half of January, which more than made up for a period earlier in the month which grabbed all the headlines for the lack of snow. The important thing to remember about this latest smoking policy, says Alexis, is that it is just the latest step in a whole series of actions taken. And we're not actually banning smoking. People can still smoke in one of the five designated smoking areas. What has ended is the more indiscriminate or normal smoking at any point along the piste. Although skiing is a healthy outdoor exercise, smokers are often seen taking a fag break at the top of the mountain, beside the gondola station, sitting in an open ski lift, or even occasionally while sliding down the mountain. Over the years, Léger has been very focused on keeping their resort as clean and green as possible. The resort has been gradually adding more and more year-round activities to its winter ones. Already one of Europe's best cross-country biking sites in the summer, it has added golf, the Alta Lumina light show, and a superb spa to its global warming-proof menu. And with a Four Seasons toboggan run to come, the future looks clear and smoke-free for the foreseeable. For RTE World Report in Léger, Northern French Alps, this is Connor Power.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.